Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for October 2020, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This month's interview is with Grace Elizabeth Hale about her book, Cool Town, How Athens, Georgia Launched Alternative Music and Changed American Culture. Back in the summer of 1978, the B-52s conquered the New York Underground. A year later, the band's self-titled debut burst onto the Billboard charts. The fact that the group had formed in the sleepy southern college town of Athens, Georgia, only increased the fascination. Soon, more Athens bands followed the B-52s into the vanguard of the new American music that would come to be known as alternative, including REM, who catapulted over the course of the 80s to the top of the musical mainstream. In Athens in the 80s, if you were young and willing to live with that much money, anything seemed possible. Grace Elizabeth Hale experienced the Athens scene as a student, small business owner, and band member. Blending personal recollection with a historian's eye, she reconstructs the networks of bands, artists, and friends that drew on the things at hand to make a new art of the possible, transforming American culture along the way. I began my interview with Grace Elizabeth Hale by asking her what inspired her to write a book about Athens, Georgia, and these cool bands that all came from this city in the South.
Well, you know, I'll answer that tangentially to start with just to say that I kept thinking someone should document it.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. A really close friend who had lived in Athens a long time, not as a participant in the scene, but as a scholar at the University of Georgia, kept saying to me, that somebody is you. No, that's not me. Somebody else should do it. But he said, you know, you're the person who should do it because you are trained as a cultural historian, but you also have this lived experience, so you should do it. But I don't think I really came around to that idea, to be fair, until Vic Chestnut died. And I'd known Vic well at a certain point in my life, and his wife, Tina Chestnut. I wasn't in touch with him at the time that he died because I wasn't living in Athens. But that was the thing that really said to me, you know, people are not going to always be there for you to interview, for you to talk to.
Yeah.
If the somebody is me, you need to get started. Now, I didn't get started right away because I was in the middle of another book project, but that really sort of galvanized my sense that I needed to, somebody needed to do this work, and if nobody else had popped up by the time I finished the book that I was then working on, that somebody might just have to be me.
So take us back here. Describe what Athens was like in Georgia for those who just may not, who know the bands, obviously, the B-52s, the big names, Vic and Chestnut and REM, but know virtually nothing about Athens, Georgia. What kind of city are we talking about where all these cool musicians came from?
You know, it's a pretty small place. It was a place in the 80s. This is not so much true now, but if you were to come into town in the late 70s, especially even through the early mid 80s, into town, you would sort of wonder, you know, why does anybody think this is special? it was a small town appended to a giant state university, known mostly for Georgia football, Bulldog football, and for the university there. And the town was very much, a kind of time capsule. Some of the downtown still had the kind of stores that catered mostly by that point to working class residents of Athens, because the sort of nicer retail, et cetera, had moved, well, was in the course of the 80s, you know, moving into strip malls and indoor malls out of the downtown. So it was an interesting mix then, what you would call the town part of, you know, restaurants that catered to the university right across the main street, or shops that appealed to, you know, more working class white and black residents, wig shops, for example, you know, music shops, not for college students, but for the locals, that kind of thing. So it was in some ways a place that seemed sort of stuck back in a kind of Southern small town past, if you got more than a block away from the university. But much was percolating under the surface, I would say. So, you know, you had to just kind of dig in a little bit to find the music scene.
It was just very recently on my radio station, where I'm the proud morning drive host, Ann Arbor's 107.1. We featured the B-52s over the July 4th weekend. And I don't know if I'm daft or what, but I think that they're just a quintessential American band. This was absolutely perfect to celebrate over July 4th in this year unlike any other year, and try and provide some joy in a year that's been a really tough one to find any joy at all. And I never tire of hearing the B-52s and their music, which is so much fun and so captivating and so arty, but in a fun pop way. Where did this band emerge? How did they get together? I see the cover photo of your book is taken from their very first gig that they played in Athens.
Yeah, the B-52s are really wonderful, and I'm so glad to hear you speak about them with such high praise, because I think that they don't always get their due because they're so fun, because they just give you pleasure to hear them. I don't think that music critics and some sort of serious music fans have really recognized how brilliant they are. And I think both of those things are true. They're both fun and brilliant. And I think their story is really emblematic of all of Athens. You know, on the one hand, you know, music critics are presenting them when they're first starting to become popular as this kind of like bizarre, you know, weird, you know, gourd that grows out of southern ground somehow, you know, that they're just like almost idiot savants that just, you know, emerge in this weird place, and that accounts for their eccentricities. And I think the problem with that story is it really discounts their brilliance and their craft and how much thinking is going into this project. You know, this isn't something that just happens. But the key kind of backstory is that Keith Strickland and Ricky Wilson became friends in high school, going to high school. They grew up in Athens, and they actually had an older friend who went by Jerry Ayers, then later became Jeremy Ayers. He, too, had grown up in Athens. His dad was a professor at the university. And he, in the 70s or maybe late 60s, I guess late 60s, had gone to New York City, and somehow there had connected up with Andy Warhol's factory crowd and become one of Andy Warhol's superstars with the superstar name Silva Thin, during the era when Andy Warhol was hanging out with drag queens. And Jerry Ayers became the drag queen Silva Thin. And he was friends with all the famous, you know, Warhol crowd and the other famous drag queens. And at some point, Ricky and Ricky Wilson and Keith, you know, got on the bus. Keith Wilson's dad ran the bus station, so they probably got a free ticket or a discounted ticket, and they took the bus to New York. And the next thing they knew, they were learning how to go to thrift shops and buy, you know, weird clothes and dress up and perform with this kind of Warhol crowd. And so there is a kind of real connection to other avant-garde and other kinds of performative artistic communities going on here. They didn't just invent this out of whole cloth. They had this kind of direct experience, and Jerry Ayers in the 70s moves back to Athens and really becomes part of the local community. And back in Athens, they're all hanging out with a lot of other people connected, some connected to the university, and particularly the art school, some local residents. There's a very vibrant, somewhat out gay community there that they're connected to, and they really begin to kind of create sort of their vision of the factory, of Warhol's factory in Athens.
How did Keith and Ricky meet up with the rest of the B-52s, with Cindy Wilson and Kate Pearson and Fred Schneider? How did the band ultimately come together?
Yeah, well, you know, I can't reconstruct the exact chain of who knew whom first, but they met because they were in their various ways drawn to this community of people who saw themselves as sort of the outsiders or the weirdos in town, many of whom were gay or in other ways not straight, and they connected through a kind of mutual sort of, you know, sympathy or interest in that kind of activity. So, you know, so Jerry is definitely a conduit. I believe that Jerry knew Kate Pearson. He met Kate Pearson somehow, and that's how she met Ricky and Keith. Fred and Keith met at a concert that the University of Georgia Concert Division of the Student Union put on outside on the campus, and they met because they were the sort of two, you know, most interesting people partying at the outdoor concert. You know, they sort of decided they should know each other. And you know, those kinds of connections happened in this world, and that's how they came together. They were sort of a subset of a larger group of friends, but they were the ones who just happened to get together to start making music, and out of that, really almost as much a performance art kind of a activity as it was a band at the start. They had much of the music on a recording, Ricky Wilson owned a tape recorder, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and they taped a lot of the music and only played some of the instruments live in their first performance, because it was mostly a kind of cabaret, you know, a performance, a costumed performance as much as what we would think of as a band. So I think people really don't understand those kind of deep roots in the art world and in ideas about performance art and drag, and also in, you know, gay, queer culture. You know, people obviously understand that the B-52s have a connection to gay culture. I don't mean that, but just how rooted it is in that certain kind of sense of the art and culture of that time and place.
Now, Grace, where was the B-52s breakthrough in terms of breaking through to a wider audience and getting signed to a major label? Did that happen in New York?
Well, you know, they were living in Athens when it happened, and I think the B-52s are super, super interesting because they show us that what is going on in the world when punk is turning into post-punk, and before we have indie or alternative culture, and before people can actually make musical careers in other ways. You know, all those early, what we think of as American punks, and people in New York like Patti Smith and others, they all signed major record labels. There really isn't the kind of alternative indie record label world that is about to happen, right?
Yeah.
And so the B-52s are in Athens. They're hugely popular in underground New York, almost commuting to New York, you know, 19 hours.
Oh, you know, that long.
Down the road.
Whoa.
At that time. And, or at least that's what they always laughingly say. And, they're in Athens, but if they want to play for like an A&R person from a record label, they have to rent a venue. So they rent the Georgia Theater, which isn't then a music venue, and put on their own production, or they have to set something up in Atlanta. Ricky Wilson is going to the University of Georgia Law Library to read up on contracts to try to figure out how to look at these contracts they're being offered. There is not even that kind of indie infrastructure, if that makes sense, that is going to happen in places like Athens, in part because of the B-52s, but it doesn't exist yet. So they're really sort of betwixt and between. And I think that, you know, that is much of what propels them to move to New York. They don't, you know, it's not conceivable that they can have this musical career otherwise.
It's so interesting. I'm going to be featuring this weekend on my Sunday show music from another band who I just truly, truly treasure, who couldn't be more different from the B-52s in style and tone, and that's the group Joy Division. And this boggles my mind. This coming up shortly is the 40th anniversary of the band's second and final studio album, Closer. And it's just so interesting to contrast and compare the music of Joy Division, again, and some of the other bands that I still love, Gang of Four and Wire, who, you know, really ultra serious bands, and it's just so, again, this refreshing breeze to hear the B-52s, who again are as artful and as serious about what they were doing, but doing it in a way that just make you smile and make us laugh and make us dance. And I guess just as the years have gone by and as I've gotten older, it just seems more important than ever that we've got bands like the B-52s, and maybe over the years I've come to cherish them even more, because I've always liked that really serious stuff, but the stuff that is a little more dance oriented or fun oriented is still just so important as well. But before we move into another incredibly popular band that came out of Athens, REM, can you talk about a group that maybe not that many listeners know of, but you know about them, you write about them extensively, and I love them too, the band Pylon from Athens?
Yeah, I think Pylon's a really wonderful example of a band, somewhat like another one you just mentioned, Gang of Four, obviously not from Athens, that sort of is a bridge between the kind of music, the wonderfully fun music. I completely agree with you on the B-52s and the music of these more serious groups, Joy Division or even, you know, later REM. So I think they're a wonderful kind of segue. Pylon is a band that, you know, hopefully maybe someday actually will get their due. They're about to re-release their entire catalog this fall.
Really?
I think on New West Records.
Ooh.
I should have checked that. So hopefully that will spark something of a Pylon reunion, but they're an amazingly quintessential Athens band, and maybe in some ways the band most important in making Athens a scene. You know, the B-52s have this great fun group of friends, but that isn't really a music scene, or it could just pass, you know, as those people move away or grow up, that could be over. And it's really Pylon, I think, that makes the town a scene. They emerge when B-52s are still living in Athens. In fact, members of the B-52s come to their third show that spring in 1979, right before the B-52s are going to permanently move away. And they are started by four art students. Some have graduated, some are still at school at the time that they form, and they're worried that a band isn't original at this point, because we've already had the B-52s and they know them well enough and have been to some of their shows, and there's another band called the Tone Tones, and you know, this has been done. You know, there's the idea that this has been done. So they come up with this idea that they'll start a band as a performance art project, because they're all pretty serious in terms of their ideas about themselves as practicing artists, right? So they'll start a band as a performance art project, and they'll carry it on long enough to get a gig in New York City and get written up in the underground rock press. They really want to be written up in New York Rocker, and then they'll break up. The whole thing will just be an art project. And that provides them with a kind of way to get into music while worrying about it not being original, which I think is just really, really fascinating. But the band that comes out of that is Pylon. So much about that band really sort of sets up the model for many, many bands that come after them in Athens, although not that most famous band, REM. But first and foremost, they're all amateur musicians. They're learning to play their instruments in the band, with the exception a little bit of Curtis Crow, who's drummed with a group of friends in a band from Marietta, his hometown. But the rest of them are all really learning on the job. Randy Bewley and Michael Lahusky, you know, get their instruments at pawn shops and thrift stores and just, you know, buy, like, you know, get a how-to book and just start trying to teach themselves how to play. And in that way, they develop just a really sort of original kind of sound and a way that the bass and the guitar relate to each other. And the kind of alternative guitar tunings, which Ricky Wilson did in the B-52s, again, coming out of a kind of self-taught amateur music making practice. Randy Bewley does the same thing. He doesn't know the standard guitar tuning for a long time. so he just doesn't know what it is. So that plays a role there, and that becomes a kind of characteristic of a lot of Athens bands, that amateurism can help you to see things in a fresh way, to create new kinds of sounds, new musical gestures that people who have more conventional training won't come to or won't imagine.
All right, let's jump into the story of REM, if we could, Grace. Not all of these guys, in fact, only Michael Stipe is from Georgia originally. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, I think they're an interesting group. They all have some family ties to the South, and some mostly to Georgia, but they're also their families move around and live in other places. So, you know, there is always a kind of debate amongst people who care about such things, whether or not they're Southerners, which I think is interesting given how by a certain point in the history of the band, they very much do claim the South and Athens and their Southernness. But in terms of their growing up years, like Mike Mills and Bill Berry grow up in Macon, Georgia, I mean, spend their high school years in Macon, Georgia, and in that sense really do, you know, they're rooted in that place. Michael Stipe, famously military brat, grows up all over the country and the world, so a different kind of trajectory there, even though grandparents are from Georgia. And Bill Berry Pete Buck lives in California, you know, some of the time before coming back to Georgia. I believe he finishes high school in the Atlanta suburbs. I think I'm right about that. And then goes to Emory, of all places, to college before ending up working at a record store in Athens. So REM's got a super interesting history on that front, but they all end up in town, three of them, to go to college. Pete Buck sometimes takes some night classes at Georgia, but really in town to work at a record store. And, of course, the rest is history. We can certainly talk more about REM.
Yeah, it's very fascinating to read in your book how not everybody in Athens really, really liked this band, say, across the board. It sounds like the B-52s was just a consensus favorite, but a lot of people thought REM were a little too much of, what, a pop band? I just found that kind of strange to read, frankly. It's like, yeah. wow, why? I don't understand why.
Well, I think one thing that Cool Town, that my book has to really offer readers, is a history of REM and how this particular community, this emerging Athens scene that they're a part of, really shapes the band that they become, and how they as a band then also shape Athens. So I think there's a lot there for REM fans. But in the early days of the band, after they debut, I mean, everybody thinks they're fun from the first moment they hear them. And in part, it's because they don't fit this model that Pylon has kind of created, that other bands are fulfilling, and that is because they're not amateurs. I mean, Mike Mills and Bill Berry know how to play.
They played
in the band, jazz bands and marching bands, and their band director in high school had like a group on the side that played, you know, events, you know, like weddings, and they know how to play. So that gives them a different sound. And then you've got Pete Buck with his just encyclopedic knowledge of music history as a guy who works in a record store and collects records and reads all the underground music magazines and reads people like Lester Bangs. And, you know, he's got this whole kind of that whole knowledge, you know, the record store guy. And I think people today don't understand that how hard it was to have that kind of knowledge before Spotify and Amazon and you know, Apple Music, you know, that you just couldn't have access to old music unless you had a friend with a great record collection. So he brings that to bear. But a lot of people in Athens, when they hear the earliest iterations of REM, think that they're playing cover songs. Some of them are cover songs, but this is anathema to the art school crowd in Athens, that it would be like if you copied old masters, if you painted paintings that were copies of other people's paintings. You wouldn't do that. That's not your art. You have to make your own songs. And so they get really kind of snobby about the fact that they think that REM is playing cover songs. They do play a few cover songs, but the bigger problem is that they have a kind of sound that comes out of like the earliest REM, like the Nuggets compilation, the early garage band sound. They really have a very different sound than you're going to hear by the time they are recording Chronic Town. And Michael Stipe sounds almost like he's singing for the Cramps, or he's doing an Elvis Presley, copying a kind of Elvis Presley's vocal mannerisms. It's not the REM that you think, but it's really great, fun music. But the art school crowd is like, oh yeah, no, this is just not original. This is poppy. So part of it is that cover, that critique of playing covers, and part of it is the fact that some of the regular Georgia students, including, heaven forbid, some frat boys and, sorority girls, like the music and start to come to Tyrone's to hear REM. And so that kind of seals the deal for the art snobs, right? Oh, my gosh, like, who are these people? We're trying to get away from these people. So, all of this ends up being a little bit like when you're in high school, and there are these cliques that seem to mean absolutely life or death, who's in what, which crowd, and then the minute you graduate, they don't matter at all. So a lot of this early history of REM sort of becomes like that, if you know what I'm saying.
You know,
a few years down the road, none of it is relevant, and, you know, nobody has done more, for example, to make people think about Pylon as a great band than the members of REM, who have praised them in key moments over the years and helped turn critical attention to them. So it all becomes water under the bridge later on, but it is their kind of earliest reception in Athens. And I think it really shapes the way that when they're touring the country in those early years and playing in all those out-of-the-way places, the members of REM are really trying to, you know, talk to people and not be like snobby band people and really create community, if that makes sense. I mean, to me, it seems like they're trying to create something that's the opposite of that earliest kind of experience they had.
Grace, before we let you run, and there's so many other musicians and bands that you write about in your book, could you talk a little bit, though, before we let you run, about Vic Chestnut, this brilliant and this so troubled but so talented man who you also profile in your book? It is just such a compelling story that is just so, so bittersweet, this man's life.
Yeah, Vic Chestnut, he's sort of a critical darling. You know, people that are in the music business have often heard of him, but doesn't necessarily have as wide a fan base, and certainly not as wide as he desires, as he deserves. He's an incredible, incredible songwriter, really just an amazingly brilliant way with words, up there with the songwriting greats like John Prine that everybody has heard of, but someone who really struggles with the demons of depression. And, you know, the depression relates or fuels, you know, too much drinking, too many drugs, as can happen so often in the music business and other parts of American life, too, let's face it. But he really, really fights those demons. But he's an absolutely interesting figure because he comes to Athens as a young man, in his early 20s to go to the university. But by that point, he's already, he has a car crash. He crashes his van when he's in the very end of high school and ends up partially paralyzed and in a wheelchair. And that really shapes his experience navigating the world, obviously, after that. And also relates, you know, help, is one of the reasons why he struggles with the demons that he struggles with. But I've always thought that the key to understanding Vic is to realize he's a poet. You know, if some of these other earlier Athens musicians are artists, you know, who become musicians, he's a poet who becomes a musician. And for example, he always tries to write songs with words that he's never heard in a song before. You know, what's the most bizarre word that you can think of, like nobody would put that in a song, and I'm gonna write a song, you know, around having a word like conniption, or having a word, you know, some kind of a word that is not easy to make a rhyme with, for example. So he brings a kind of craft, you know, a word craft to Athens music. And also he grows up with a grandfather and grandmother who performed country music, and that sort of country music, and also the folk kind of tradition of storytelling. And he really, really creates a kind of tradition within the Athens scene of storytelling songs.
Thanks for listening to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for October 2020. Our interview was with Grace Elizabeth Hale about her book, Cool Town, How Athens, Georgia Launched Alternative Music and Changed American Culture. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.